This is Be the Story on Pulling Us Into Your World. The idea for this episode actually came from a question someone posted on one of the writers' boards. How do you write short descriptions that still give the full picture of the setting? Now, this question was, of course, about writing literature. But the answer, surprisingly enough, carries out into other media as well. When you describe where your story takes place, that's more than just listing its characteristics. It's about making the audience feel like they're really there. In this episode of Be the Story, I want to look at what makes strong settings work, two different ways in which a setting can be made to work in a story, and I'll rework a particularly egregious description from an old story of mine. That's all coming up this week on Be the Story. Welcome to Be the Story, where we celebrate stories and those who tell them. As I said, the whole idea for this episode came from one of the posts on one of the writers' boards. But then coincidentally enough, during the week over at the Kick-Ass Mystic Ninjas, Summer posted a blog entry about info dumps, also known as core dumps, expository lumps, or death to all readers. And I have to thank Holly Lyle for that last one. Let's see, what else happened during the week at BeTheStory.com? Well, the week started out pretty badly for me, and I actually blogged about it on Tuesday and Wednesday. Gilmore Girls saved my day. I don't know if you've ever had an experience like this where you're just having a really awful day, everything's going wrong, you feel sick, and all you want to do is just sit down with a good book or with a good movie or a good TV show and just kind of escape into someone else's world for a change. Thursday's spotlight was on peanut butter and tofu on Jewish rye. This was a review of the Icebox Radio Theater's production of that play by Andrew Labrizzi. And that radio drama was actually released on the Sound Stages podcast recently. Then, How to Moralize Without Getting Preachy. This is something that actually Peanut Butter and Tofu on Jewish Rye did, I thought, pretty well. And is actually, I think, a variation on what we're going to be discussing today, which I'll get to in a moment. Also on Friday, a quick little note. A follow-up to The Power of Your Personal Story from last week, Steve Pavlina posted an entry in his blog about his polyphasic sleep experiences. Polyphasic sleep, in case you haven't heard of it before, you might have heard of the Uberman sleep schedule. Basically, sleeping 6 times a day for like 20 or 30 minutes each instead of sleeping once or twice a day. And some people say, this can't even be done, it's physiologically impossible. And Steve actually gets a kick out of that, because he says he's actually done it. I guess not everyone can do it at the very least. But the problem is, you know, you can't argue with a personal success. You could say it's unhealthy, but you can't say it's impossible. There is power in the personal story. The next day, Saturday, Guilty Pleasures. We all have our guilty pleasures, and I thought I'd get some of mine out into the open, including Star Trek. Yes, I admit it, I like Star Trek. And then on Sunday, a quick little mini, somewhat kind of review of Spellbound by Nora Roberts. Not really a review, but more just my impressions of the book. It's a novella, actually. And you can read all these things at bethestory.com. A couple of comments from the blog. Will posted, in response to the spotlight on Gilmore Girls, that Amy Sherman Palladino and Daniel Palladino are working on a new show and may not be part of the seventh season of Gilmore Girls. I was not aware of that. But actually, I don't see there being very many seasons of Gilmore Girls left. So I'm not sure what's happening with the show. But I actually am kind of happy to hear that Amy and Daniel are working on something else. And so hopefully we'll continue to see their vision and their genius being revealed in other works. Also, Summer posted something that I missed due to my own stupid oversight. I knew about this, and yet I didn't mention it when I did the spotlight on Kate Wilhelm's book, Storyteller. Kate Wilhelm, the guys over at the Dragon Page Cover to Cover podcast, interviewed Kate Wilhelm last fall when the book came out. So that's posted as a comment to the Storyteller review, and there's a link to the interview archive page at the Dragon Page. I have heard this interview, and trust me, it's worth listening to if you haven't heard this interview with Kate Wilhelm. Really great stuff. Okay, we'll be right back in just a moment with Pulling Us Into Your World, How to Make Setting Come Alive for the Audience.
I'd make a promo for my new podcast, but I really should be writing. Well, the podcast isn't new. It's 10 episodes in. I've discussed the issues people have with rejection, procrastination, getting started in writing fiction, and allowing yourself to suck. You don't always have to be perfect. I don't always have to be perfect. Except, I should be writing right now. See, when you're not perfect, when you don't have to worry about the rejection slips and the dusty, unfinished novel and the fear that when you do finish it, it won't be exactly like you imagined it, you can just write. And when you write, you get better at writing. And someday you'll be good enough to maybe never have to worry about rejection again. And the novels will never get dusty. My novel is dusty. I should be writing on it. Published authors think I should be writing. I know because I interview them once in a while for my podcast. They talk about the advice I've been giving other unpublished authors and tell me their spin and whether I'm steering my listeners wrong. They're very nice, those published writers. Perhaps someday I'll be like them. Nice. And published. But to do that, I should be writing. So I'm going to do that now. But first, I guess I'll make a short promo for the podcast. Listen to I Should Be Writing, shouldwrite.blogspot.com. See us in iTunes, Odeo, and wherever fine podcasts are found, because you should be writing.
Describing where your story takes place is more than just doing a laundry list of all the things that you see in the setting. It's about making the audience feel like they're really there. How can you do this? And what's more is, how can it be the same for literature and for other media like film and video games? Now, when someone asks about descriptions and says, you know, I need shorter descriptions. How do I do shorter descriptions and still give a full picture with just a few words? They're clearly talking about literature. They're talking about novels or short stories or some other, you know, literary type work. Not only does literature rely more on words than other media does, but other media also have other ways of describing a place. For example, in film, a director might frame even just a single shot. If he frames it just right, he can give an impression of the setting that in a novel, it would take paragraphs to give the same impression of that setting. Or in a video game, the virtual world that the gamer is playing through, that world is the setting. And in fact, frequently, exploring this virtual world is part of the gameplay. It's part of the fun. But even so, you can have a deeply complex world in a video game, and it can just be boring if there's no reason for the gamer to need to explore it or even to want to explore it. As an example, in 1995, Spectrum Holobyte published a game called Star Trek The Next Generation, A Final Unity. And I know there's that Star Trek guilty pleasure coming into focus again. This is a, you know, classic style puzzle-solving adventure game. In this game, the Enterprise D must embark on several missions and ultimately complete an Uber mission that ties all the other ones together. Now, as I recall, the story was okay. It wasn't great, but I remember having a lot of fun playing this game. The game, however, was marketed. Part of the advertising campaign was that it had a complex, explorable world, and you as the gamer could explore any part of the world you wanted. You were not limited by the game's storyline. And indeed, this was true. You could decide not to take one of the stock missions that you were granted, right? You could go off and do whatever you wanted. However, when you did this, well, aside from having to fight off Romulans, if you happened into Romulan space, exploring the universe was basically about flying long distances through empty space in order to reach some destination and then find at that destination nothing. In other words, yes, the game had a full detailed world, but, you know, there was no reason why you would want to explore it. And as a result, it was really disappointing from that perspective. This very detailed setting did absolutely nothing to enhance the game. And in fact, I remember people having bought the game based on this claim and then being disappointed because they felt like they had been let down, like they had been betrayed. In the movie The Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants, I recently watched that, of course, and so it's fresh in my memory. Now, one of the four girls, Lena, she spends her summer in Greece. Now, it's interesting. Several reviewers complained that Greece is not really that white. It's not really that clean. That the setting was unrealistic. But actually, according to the DVD and other sources, I believe, these scenes in Greece were actually filmed on location in Santorini. But that's kind of beside the point. The visuals in Greece were beautiful. I remember they were breathtaking at times. But that was not enough to really make them come alive. The reason they were important, the reason the setting in Greece was important, was because of Lena's relationship with Carlos. And these two, their grandparents, had an age-old feud. And so the two families were basically separate, and Lena and Carlos were not allowed to spend time together. Now, if the setting were any place else, or at least if it were in the U.S., this conflict would not have been. As a comparison, since we're talking about Alexis Bledel, in Gilmore Girls, Rory's grandfather, right now in the sixth season, and Logan's grandfather, they don't particularly like each other right now. And yet that doesn't keep Rory and Logan from dating. That's a similar situation set in the United States. So in Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants, because this situation is set in Greece, it means something. The setting bears directly upon the conflict that the characters experience. I know I keep talking about the movie, The Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants, and I promise I do have Anne Brashear's novels on my Amazon.com wish list, and I will get to them sometime, really. So in game and film, we can see that what gives a setting power, you know, what draws you in and makes you feel part of this setting, is that the setting is involved in the story. And the same thing holds true in literature, you know, in novels or short stories or what have you. It's not description that draws you in. It's having the setting be a part of the story. Yet writers seem to be addicted to these descriptions they have. And I can understand. I've been there. We have an addiction to dumping descriptions on our readers. And frankly, I think we need to get over this addiction. Generally, if you find yourself writing descriptions, stop. Go cold turkey. Instead, take a step back, integrate the setting into the story, and then just tell the story and let the descriptions take care of themselves. This is a variation on moralizing without getting preachy. In this case, we are describing without getting expository. You see, when other elements in the story interact with the setting, then the setting becomes a part of the story, and the story actually ends up relying on the setting, and just telling the story will involve the setting. The setting, therefore, will come alive because the conflicts in the story actually rely on the setting being there and being the way it is. Here's a passage from Stanislaw Lem's story, The Conditioned Reflex, from his Tales of Perks the Pilot. Now, at this point in the story, there are three astronauts. One is Perks. These three astronauts are traveling by foot on the moon towards a science station on the moon. Neen guided them through this forest of petrified eruptions leisurely, but infallibly. Now and then, he would put his space boot on a slab. If it wobbled, he would stop and brood, then either proceed on a straight course or maneuver around it, intuiting by means of signs recognizable only to him whether or not it could sustain a man's weight. Sound, the warning signal of mountain climbers being wholly absent here. Suddenly, for no apparent reason, one of the stone witches they had passed earlier broke loose and started down the slope, slowly and somnolently at first, then bouncing and ricocheting to touch off a stampede of stone, a furious rush of rock and rubble that was gradually enveloped by milky white swirls of dust. It was a spectacle bordering on an hallucinatory vision. Collisions without noise, a mute avalanche without tremors or vibrations, thanks to the inflated boots. When they veered sharply around the next hairpin bend farther up, Perks beheld the trail left by the avalanche, a cloud of serenely undulating waves. Instinctively, with unease, his eyes scanned the horizon in search of the ship. It was safely parked in the same place as before, a kilometer or two away, its shiny hull and three hyphen-like legs clearly visible, a weird lunar spider resting on the site of an old avalanche, on what only a short while ago had seemed so precipitous, but now lay flat as a tabletop. What do we learn about the setting? Well, here are some things. It's dangerous, it's precarious, it's also completely silent, thanks to the fact that there's no atmosphere. They're in spacesuits that insulate them even from vibrations through the ground. And of course, there's also reduced gravity and dust clouds that get kicked up. They take a long time to clear since there's no wind. And we furthermore learn that Neen is the expert here, since he's leading the expedition. All of these things we learn simply by observing the implications. The focus here is on the journey. He doesn't tell us that there is less gravity on the moon here, but yet we can see this is true. He doesn't tell us that there's no atmosphere, and yet we can see that this is true. It's more important reading this that we can't hear the sounds and the effect this has on the main character, Perks. That's more important than the fact that sound doesn't travel through the moon's non-existent atmosphere. In other words, Lem doesn't give us a laundry list of descriptive clauses. He shows us how the setting is important. How it's important in the context of the conflict, that is. Actually, Lem sometimes does give us long descriptive passages, and this can work if the setting itself poses a conflict. Lem does sometimes use setting in this way. But rather than quoting again from Lem, let me instead give an example from Holly Lyle's Create a Character Clinic. This is actually from one of her novels, Hunting the Corrigan's Blood. The corpse's left eye squinted at me from mere centimeters away. Decomposition lent her face an increasingly inscrutable expression. The first time I'd regained consciousness, when I found myself tied to her, she looked like she had died in terror. After a while, she started leering at me as if she had reached the place where I was going and took perverse pleasure from the thought that I would join her there soon. Now, having had her moment of amusement at my expense, she meditated. Beneath thousands of dainty auburn braids, her face hung slack, bloated and discolored, the skin loosening. Threads of drool hung spiderwebbish from her gaping mouth, her eyes, dry and sunken and filmed over beneath swollen lids, still stared directly at me. Now, the very idea of being trapped, tied to a corpse, provides a conflict all its own. Somehow, just reading this, I get the impression that the character is closed into an enclosed space. Holly Lyle never says that he's in an enclosed space here. And yet you get that kind of a feeling of being trapped. Just describing this setting and building it up this way and stretching it out in order to build the tension, you know, it builds a conflict all of its own. So now let's look at a particularly bad passage from one of my stories. This is a story called Proletariat, which was never published, and with good reason, as you will soon see. My room was large and thoughtfully furnished. Just inside stood a small conference table with several chairs. Next to the door was mounted a large dry erase board, the opposite wall being filled with the picture windows that displayed in the distance a forest of deciduous trees. Further in, bookshelves obscured the same wall and the adjoining one. Against the windows, facing diagonally, was a desk on which sat computer and telephone. From there, I could easily gaze out the window or at the remaining wall, on which hung a watercolor rich in blues and golds of a girl cuddling a fluffy white kitten. Oh, yeah, I just get so sick just reading that. You know, I wrote this years ago. Unfortunately, not enough years for me to feel okay about having written it. You know, reading it now, all I can think about is after each sentence is, so what? Who cares about that? You know, my room was large and thoughtfully furnished. So what? Does it matter? Just inside stood a small conference table with several chairs. Big frickin' deal. Especially in a short story, which this was, you know, when you can read a single sentence and ask, so what, and not get an immediate, obvious answer, you know, you can get rid of that sentence. And in this case, I could have gotten rid of this whole paragraph without damaging the story at all. Well, such as the story was. This story had other problems besides boring descriptions. Descriptions are kind of like, you know, commercial ads. You know, if you've established enough momentum in the show, you might be able to convince the readers to bear with you through a short description or two. But it's still an imposition to the reader, and I think you have to respect that. So in a moment, I'm going to come back and let's disassemble and reassemble this paragraph and see if we can't make something out of it. Stay tuned.
I'm bored.
I'm bored too.
Hey kids, look what I've got for you.
Kick-Ass Mystic Ninja Bits!
Yes, you asked for it, and here they are. Kick-Ass Mystic Ninja Bits are chock full of information, reviews, and links to exciting sci-fi sites with buttery goodness. So hurry up and go to www.kickassmysticninjas.com for your own tasty ninja bits today.
And they're educational too. Wow!
Roswell, UFOs, Atlantis, time travel, hollow earth, dwarf, underground bases, reincarnation, levitation, prehistory, giants, abductions, and the pig man. The pig man? What on earth is the pig man? To find out more on the pig man and all the latest news from the other side, join me, Ben Grundy, for Mysterious Universe. Visit www.sohpodcast.com or search for Mysterious Universe in your favorite podcast directory.
Welcome back to Be the Story. We're talking about an old story of mine that I'm kind of embarrassed about. It's really bad. And we're looking at one particular paragraph, a description, which, again, is really bad, and trying to make something of it. So let me give you just a bit of backstory regarding the story. Now, the main character in the story is a very moral person, and also very overworked. He's an entrepreneur who sleeps at the office. And just before this paragraph, when he goes into his office, he meets with the receptionist and finds out that he got a phone message. And he's very excited about this phone message and anxious to return it. Okay. Now, in the description, what are the elements of his office, the elements of the setting? Well, there's a large room. It's a large room, right? There's a conference table or a small conference table in the room. A large dry erase board on one of the walls. A window that looks out into the forest. A desk with a computer and phone on it. Lots of bookshelves. And over against one wall, or on one wall, there's a watercolor portrait of a girl and kitten. I'm not sure why I put that there. It must have been to give the place character or something. I don't know. Who knows? Anyway, lots of stuff here. And still, it's missing something pretty important for this particular character, at least. It's missing a couch. You know, the thing that he sleeps on when he's not going home to his non-existent apartment because he spends all the time at the office? Well, what are the implications of this setting? In other words, how might we show instead of tell? Or alternatively, do any elements of the setting imply anything about the character and the conflicts he faces? Well, let's go to the sofa, which we need to add that into the description. We need to add that into the scene, right? Let's say he sleeps on a sofa in the corner. There we go. That tells us something about the character. Maybe there's a book from some small corner of the bookshelves that he is allocated to fiction, you know, fun stuff to read. And maybe this book is on a small table next to the sofa, and he bookmarked it where he finished reading it the night before. He walks into the office and, you know, sometimes feels kind of lost and alone in this large office, except when there are other people there with him. And that's the true reason why he has a conference table, so that there are other people working in the office with him. Of course, his employees, they feel pressured by the fact that he works such long hours, right? The view through the window. Maybe as he sits at his desk, he pauses and looks at the view and starts having doubts about his way of life. The portrait of the little girl and the kitten. Maybe it's actually a portrait of his niece. And, you know, this represents his decision to be a hyperactive businessman rather than starting a family. That choice that he has made, and maybe he's reevaluating that choice or reevaluates it from time to time. So let's put these into a new paragraph. And this paragraph now is not really to describe the office. It's to describe the character and the conflict that he faces. In other words, to tell part of the story. I walked around the conference table on my way to my desk. The official reason for keeping a small conference table in my office was so that I could have business meetings in a convenient location. My employees hated me for it, I could tell. These surroundings pressured them. I stopped and reminisced at the notes on the dry erase board covering the near wall. Having people near broke up the loneliness, like having guests over for dinner. I turned to look at the couch in the opposite corner. A novel lay on a small table next to it, bookmarked from the night before. I'd recently begun spending a few minutes each night engaging in fun reading, and had even allocated to fiction a small corner of the expanse of bookshelves. My eye floated up to the portrait hanging above the sofa, a watercolor rich in blues and golds of my young niece cuddling a fluffy white kitten. My sister's family had given it to me 2 years ago for the holidays, and little Samantha was already nothing like the little girl in the picture. I had long given up the idea of having a family, however. It simply was not a priority. I turned and sat at my desk. My hand rested on the phone, but I simply gazed out the large picture window at a forest of reds and yellows and oranges, the autumn colors. For just a moment, a deep melancholy washed over me. Then I lifted the receiver and dialed. Well, a little better, no? Next week on Be the Story. Next week is Valentine's Week. So, next week, next Monday, Feeling the Romance and Keeping it Real. This is actually an extension of what we talked about this week, because good, strong descriptions are pretty integral to romance writing. But instead of pulling the audience into a setting, we're pulling them into the minds and feelings of the characters. So that's next week, Feeling the Romance and Keeping it Real. Next week on Be the Story. I'll see you then.